with our break, but now it's time to get set again. As you may see, Jeremy is not feeling too well, but let's hope that all goes well, and Samba revives us all. Our next talk is by Jeremy Allison from Google, and also a member of the Samba team, The Evolution of I.O. in Samba.
Thanks very much. Can everyone hear me at the back? Yeah? Okay. I'm sorry, this is not going to be my usual dynamic talk. Some of you may have noticed I'm not feeling so great right now. But, you know, this is show business, and the show must definitely... Yeah, pretty much, or the last stage. So if I suddenly have to turn off the microphone and rapidly exit the stage, Volker has promised, completely without seeing my slides, to pick up and take over. The good thing is he knows this topic at least as well as I do, so he will be able to do that. So the description in the program actually was quite interesting, because it turned out that I originally submitted a talk about writing VFS modules, only to find that Richard had done the same talk, which I'm terribly sorry I missed, Richard. I was looking forward to that. And so, despite it saying async IO in Samba, the talk description was all about VFS modules. It touches a little bit on VFS modules, but that's not really what it's about. And the other thing is, feel free to raise your hand and ask questions at any time during the talk. And if you shout loud, you can probably blow me over at the moment. So in the beginning, there were the system calls, and they were lseek, read, and write. And at least for I.O., that's pretty much all we needed. You know, what would happen is the client would send usually about 4K of data in a write request, or request 4K of data in a read request. We would parse the packet and then seek to the correct position in the file, and then do the standard write or read. And so that was basically it. For a very long time within Samba, or most of the 1.x series, simply did that. And it worked rather well. I did do a graph for that. So you can see there's the client, the network, and the server. And this will be similar for most of the graphs, and there's time going downwards. So as you can see, everything's completely synchronous. You get the read or the write request, goes into user space. We do the system calls into the kernel buffer cache. There's a mem copy from the kernel buffer cache into user space, and then another copy into the TCP stack when we're doing the reply. So very simple. Not terribly elegant, but as I said, it worked rather well. So as Obi-Wan might have said, it was it's cut the top off. Oh, no. It was a simpler server for a more simple age of clients. So you're going to miss some of the titles and, in fact, some of the text. Can we bring it? Oh, never mind. Okay, I'm going to talk you through it. I would have to get up out of that chair to do this chair to do something, and right now that's not going to happen. Old DOS, Windows 3, and Windows 9X, they just didn't issue multiple outstanding read-write requests on the wire. Maybe Windows 9X did. I forgot to ask Jim that one. But the maximum read and write requests in the protocol were defined at 64K. But most of the clients used a much smaller max buffer size, which I believe is in the negotiate. And so the I/O sizes are around 4 or 8K. So nothing was going very fast. So this preceded the modern pre-read and pre-write system calls, which allow you to seek to an offset and do a read or write atomically. So one of the interesting things that Samba used to be used for, and in fact I believe still can be used for, is you could actually create a Unix FIFO in the file system as a pipe into another process. And a Windows client could actually communicate directly with a Unix process, kind of a primitive form of RPC, via Samba by just reading and writing to that file and having Samba ignore the LSeq ePipe errors and just do the reads and writes, which would be then picked up at the other side of the FIFO. And every time we break that, even now, people come out of the woodwork and say, you broke my legacy system I've had running for 20 years. So we have to make sure it still works. So here's the first read optimization that I think Tridge did around the 1.9.15 age. So what we did was we thought, well, you know, maybe we can cut out some of those system calls. So on a read-only file and for a read-only, if we knew it was a read-only file, and this was back when file sizes were small, nobody was copying around 7 gig movie images, we would quite simply mmap the entire file into the process space. And when it issued reads, we would just do a memcopy straight out of that into the TCP buffers. And that actually did help. So let's see. I think it still ended up doing two copies, because it did an mmap, followed by a memcopy out of the mmap region into the outgoing buffer. And then, of course, when the outgoing buffer was sent out the TCP pipe via the send, there was another memcopy. But the reason we ended up removing this was that if someone on the file system happened to truncate that file while we had it mmapped, we'd get a seg fault that we weren't prepared to handle. Bus error, thank you, Volker. And so we decided that having a server that was a little bit faster but not very reliable was probably a bad idea, and so we took it out. But around that time, we added read prediction, where obviously clients would very commonly read a file linearly. This was before, I think, they could send us hints that they were going to do that. And so what we would do is, when we saw a read for one SMB segment, we would issue a read for the next segment as well on a read-only file, hopefully to have it ready for when the next read came in. So how many people know about the write cache in Samba? Ah, so there's three people in the room, and they're all Samba team members. So this is actually a nefarious piece of code that more people probably should know about. It was done when I was at SGI, when we were trying to make Samba go very fast on XFS file systems. Now, the thing about XFS was it really liked to read and write in RAID stripe sizes. And you could get tremendous throughput if you would do that. The problem is, of course, the Windows clients of the day didn't know and didn't care and weren't terribly cooperative on issuing the correct read and write sizes. So what I did was I thought, well, these are big Unix systems. They have, you know, 4 megabytes of memory or however much it was at the time. And so I can probably burn some memory here. So as the stripe sizes were things like 256K, what I did was I just malloced a chunk of memory which would be used on uplocked files as a read and write cache. So when the client, obviously this was not wasn't done on write through files, but what we would do is the client would open or create the file, we would create the cache buffer. Excuse me. And reads and writes would be done into that. And then eventually, when that buffer was full or a write overlapped in some way, we would flush the entire thing out to disk in a continuous stripe size. And this code is still in there today. And there are some occasions where it's extremely useful and will speed up Samba. So do a man on smb.conf and look up write cache. Yes, Volker. Thank you.
I recently had to tune that for a customer with a file system that was optimized for really large writes. The individual write was slow, but it didn't matter if you just wrote 1 byte or 1 gigabyte, or not that, but I mean, writing large chunks really helps there.
So yeah, it tends to be, that's why people don't know about it, because generally you don't want to turn it on, and it has incredibly complex logic to deal with file truncations and extends. And when we get the logic wrong, it corrupts your files. So, you know, we've had some adventures. But every time I've suggested, well, you know, it's now the 2000s. Why don't we just take this code out? Volker says, no, don't you dare. I have customers who need this stuff. And so it's an interesting idea that does work well in some very specific situations. And the cache will basically move along as the write area moves along. So it's not fixed at a certain region of the file. So if you look in SMBD, source3 SMBD fileio.c, you can see there's a ton of ASCII art in there, which is the only thing that managed me to keep me sane when I was working out the boundary conditions for writes, you know, beyond the region, in the middle of the region, etc. So it's kind of fun code. So I'm really sorry I missed Richard's talk on the VFS. But for me, the VFS is one of our crowning achievements in Samba, I think. It's man's first use of tools in our evolution. And the reason for that is it allowed an absolute explosion of creativity in the file system backend opportunities for Samba and people using Samba. Because the original VFS was designed around the very simple POSIX interface, it was really easy for people to write all sorts of tiny little VFSs that just hooked 2 or 3 calls, exactly the ones they needed, to do exactly what they needed for whatever weird thing they were doing. I believe somebody once said that every program expands until it can send mail or is linked to Perl. Common Lisp, okay. This is at the point where somebody linked us to Perl using a VFS. And it allows you to tune your file system in ways that if you had to change the core Samba code and submit it upstream, you would never bother to do it. So we can do read-aheads on files, we can do space pre-allocation, there's a recycle bin that has a load of fans, there's code in there. And because, remember, every single code path that touches the disk goes through this code, you can change file names on the fly, you can return file names in different orders, you can filter out file names you don't want. This is the place where the antivirus vendors hook into Samba to basically send opens off to their daemons so that they can scan before they allow a client to open. And the other thing, and I don't know who did this, my suspicion is probably it was Metz, but the design was made stackable, which is really nice because it means you only, thank you very much. You only have to do a trivial amount of modification. If you want to make a tiny change to a very complex code path, essentially you interpose your module, you make the tiny change, and then you pass it down to the underlying standard modules underneath, the stackable modules underneath. And it really led to an explosion of activity around the Samba file system and IO path. And it's still there today. For instance, there was one customer who had I was working with, who they had a clustered file system, and they wanted to, whenever a certain area was touched, it was very slow refreshing Windows Explorer. So what they decided to do was to write a custom module that as soon as this call came in to open that directory in that area, they would basically spin off a process that would essentially just do read ahead on every single directory entry. So yeah, the first time you went into that directory entry, it was slow, but the read ahead process that you spun off from the OpenDIR populated the buffer cache underneath, and so every subsequent directory scan was incredibly fast. And there are all sorts of just wildly creative and crazy things that people have done with the VFS. So I'm very pleased with it. Like I say, it's the cave paintings in, you know, in France, I believe, for Samba. So then we started to get somewhat sophisticated with our tools. So we heard about this call that had been implemented for HTTP servers for very fast returning of files called send file. How many people here know what send file is? Okay, some, but not most. So send file is a very clever system call. What it essentially does is it allows you to say, here's an open file handle on the disk. Here's a TCP stream going back out. At this offset for the open file on disk, I want you to bypass user space completely and copy directly from the kernel buffer cache into the outgoing TCP buffer stream. And so it only works on SMB and SMB2 redexes, but you can see how that's done. The request comes in from the client. You pass the request to make sure it really is what you think it is. Then you create the initial SMB or SMB2 header reply. Excuse me, you're going to send back. Stick it out the TCP pipe. Then you call send file. And that bypasses user space completely and does a zero copy flip of the buffer cache into the outgoing TCP stream. And it's very fast. That actually brings at least 10% performance on doing reads. And it can be more on systems with older CPUs or the slower CPUs. It's a very, very handy call. Of course, that's basically what I just said. It doesn't work for signed requests, which is a pain because if you've got a signed data stream or, in fact, an SMB1 encrypted data stream, you can't use it. And it won't work for SMB2 encryption for obvious reasons, because the user space that would have to calculate the signature never sees the data. But on a regular non-signed connection, it's very useful. The problem is, of course, this being Unix, Sun implemented it one way, SGI implemented it another, HP another still, Linux and BSD different again. We managed to abstract it behind a VFS interface that works out what kind of system we're on and calls the correct one. And that's a very, very useful call. So here we are getting really fancy. So the first thing I thought when I saw the send file call is, oh, that's great. I'm sure they made it symmetrical. That would have been smart, wouldn't it? If you want to do zero copies from the buffer cache to the TCP layer, you're obviously going to want to do the reverse. So when you're receiving files, you want to do a zero copy from the TCP buffers into the buffer cache. No, think again. You know, when I raised this, you know, the comments were kind of like, well, that's really hard. We just thought we'd do it one way, which is a big pain, actually, because for writes, obviously, receive file would be extremely useful. So one of our OEMs, Isilon, who was working with Samba at the time, thought, you know what? We've got free BSD. We don't have to give any code back to those scumbags. We can write it ourselves. And so they did. And they implemented the initial code path for receive file in Samba, and they added their own system call to their custom version of FreeBSD. And again, it doesn't work with signed requests. They instrumented every single write call path, which when they submitted the patch upstream, I decided to remove a lot of it because essentially they touched every single write code path. And the only one that you really care about is WriteX or the SMB2 writes. Right now, it doesn't work with SMB2 writes, but it does work with WriteX. The code got into Samba, and because it was so useful, we actually ended up writing a user space receive file implementation that essentially does, you know, read, write, pretends to be doing send file, even though it's not doing zero copy, in the hope that Linux would eventually implement that system call. So Linus ended up implementing a system call that looks like it would do the job, but, and I haven't really dug into it, it doesn't do the right thing. I'm not quite sure why. You see, it does do the right thing? But there are issues. Anyway, so they implemented a splice call. Now, a splice call connects an incoming TCP stream to a pipe, and it uses it essentially as a staging buffer. And so you splice from the TCP stream into the pipe, and then you call splice again to splice the data from the incoming pipe to the outgoing buffer cache. The problem is, every time we've tried to use this call, it makes Samba go slower, and I don't know why. So this is, if anyone here are kernel experts, that would be a fun investigation to do. It turns out that calling through receive file and our crappy in-user space, you know, copy in, copy out, actually beats the so-called zero copy implementation on Linux, which is weird. So obviously, all these are synchronous mechanisms of doing I/O. And what you really want to do is have asynchronous I/O. So how many people are familiar with the POSIX real-time standards? Anybody? Oh, okay, so there's some people who have the same perverse interest that I have. So when that came out, I thought, you know what? We can use this to finally make our reads and writes asynchronous. So you get an incoming read or write. You gather it into the user space, and then you flip it into the kernel using either an AIO read or an AIO write. Then you get notification. Then essentially you return at that point. You don't return to the client. You just continue processing other SMBs. Then eventually you'll get notification that your I/O is complete or has failed or something. And then you collect the reply, whether it was an error code or not, and send it back to the client. All very nice, all very efficient. It was a boatload of code to get right. And in fact, in some ways, the signal handling that had to be done was possibly the genesis of T-Event Signal, I think. It's a horrible interface. I mean, a horrible, horrible interface. It depends on POSIX real-time signals for notification, which means that your entire code stack has to be signal safe, which luckily for us, we already were because of the op-lock notification being done by POSIX real-time signals. However, Linus took one look at the interface and said, this sucks, I'm not doing this in kernel. We'll do something better, something different. So glibc, trying to be standards compliant, implemented a version of this in user space, and they did it using pthreads. More on this later. The Linux kernel implementation of asynchronous I/O, it's finally baked to the point where it works, but it doesn't look anything like the POSIX AIO calls. It has some problems. Semantics of operations like cancel are very weird. And I'm not quite sure what it means, so right now we mostly ignore them. And the other issue is, it turned out that it didn't really help much because the Windows, older Windows clients, before Windows Vista, would only issue a single outstanding I/O, read or write, per thread. So even being asynchronous doesn't actually buy you very much. So then we have the dark ages with Pope Ulrich Drecker. Drecker is the Raptor Pope. So the glib implementation sounded great. We started using it, and it wasn't until a little while later that NoAM on Linux, apparently on Solaris it does work fine, but NoAM on Linux came back to me and said, you know, this turning on IO doesn't work. It doesn't help. You know, we've tried all sorts of things, and, you know, using modern Windows clients, it doesn't make things faster. And I said, oh, of course, you must be wrong. You know, it's obviously working. Let me go take a look. So they showed me some test code they had that actually avoided Samba completely, because sometimes when you're trying to evaluate something, having Samba in the way makes the performance analysis very hard. And so it turns out that the implementation that Ulrich did serializes multiple I/O requests on the same file descriptor. So you only ever have one outstanding I/O request per file descriptor. This is never what you would want. I mean, this is just crazy. So I took this queuing system out of glibc and sent Ulrich a patch, which he ignored, and pointed out that there's an AIO init call that actually explicitly allows the calling application to tell glibc how many outstanding events it would like to have per file descriptor. And that's when he stopped answering email completely. So I'm hoping that with the glibc steering committee taking over again, or disbanding itself, or whatever it is it did, that might work a little better. The other issue is that because glibc implemented everything using pthreads, and Samba changes UIDs, there were occasions when Samba had changed its UID back to root, and the pthread was running. The notification, it's either Linux threads or pthreads. I think it's pthreads. Essentially, we had an issue where the notification couldn't be delivered because it didn't have permissions to send the signal to the process anymore. So we actually solved this, or the Tridge found this and solved it, using an utterly hideous hack in our set UID code, which I can go into at some point. But that really is, it's a hideous hack, but it does work. That should be libsmb. Again, we're getting a little mangled by the display. So here is something that a very clever man sat in the front row implemented. Talking about Volker here, just in case his ears are burning. So he thought, well, just because Windows clients don't do multiple outstanding SMB IOs, there's no reason to say that libsmb client can't do that. So he put a lot of work into our client code to drive the SMB connection as hard as it can possibly go. So he will fill a pipeline with reads or writes up to the max mux on SMB1. And if we handle them asynchronously, we can have multiple outstanding requests into the disk system. And as one of them returns, as soon as he sees a return, he issues another one to keep the pipe full in that direction. And he proved you could saturate gigabit with SMB traffic, which... 10 gigabit too. Oh, well done. Yeah. And it's the pipelining that does this. And outstanding performance improvements, which I believe that Steve's SIFSFS client in the Linux kernel, in the latest Linux kernels, now does the same thing. So for all you people still using NFS between Linux and Linux, switch to Samba. It's faster. And this was originally one of the benefits of SMB2, one of the touted benefits of SMB2. So one of the reasons we didn't get around to SMB2 for a while, because we were already that fast. So the new Windows redirectors from Vista onwards will actually correctly do multiple outstanding IOs. I thought it was might be it's an improved Explorer shell, but it's actually in the redirector, rewritten redirector. And SMB2 will do multiple outstanding IOs, and it will do very large read and write sizes. Although 2.0, which is what we implement out of the box right now, is still restricted to 64K. But you can still get a significant amount of throughput using 64K reads and writes. Anyway, so essentially supporting IO became a requirement to get really good performance with clients getting more clever and Vulkus code being available. So you have no idea, Volker, how hard it is to find a picture of you on the internet. So I had to make do with Charles Darwin. He doesn't seem to exist. So in our evolution, here's the moment Charles Darwin explained it all with VFS AIO fork, which got around the glibc issue on Linux by...
And the real-time signal on RHEL 5. Oh.
Ah, okay. Well, there you go. Well, it's very good to have the man who wrote the code sitting in the room. And the real-time signal issue on RHEL 5, by essentially spawning a process pool. And the parent process uses file descriptor passing to pass the file descriptive IO to the subprocess. And there is an mmapped shared area, shared memory buffer, sat below, that they use to communicate back the reads and the writes. And this actually then properly drives the disks asynchronously. And the really, really clever part of this code is it all sits behind the Samba VFS POSIX AIO interface. And so there was no code changes needed to the main SMB daemon. And this is what I mean by the advantages of having that VFS layer. Volker, because that VFS layer was complete, Volker was able to write this thing that essentially completely changed the way Samba did all I/O using a process pool. And he did it without changing a line of the core code in SMBD. And that's incredible achievement, actually. I think I actually already said this. So the only issues are, it's very clever. It uses pipes for notification. It's kind of resource intensive. So if you're on a platform that doesn't have cheap processors, this is an expensive way to do AIO, but it does work. So it's very efficient on Linux. And the other issue is it introduces another memcopy. So it's such a beautiful piece of code, but you know, all code could be better. So this is where hedonism bot from Futurama says, I regret nothing. I shamelessly stole Volker's code, not afraid to deny it, to admit it. And I changed his process pool function to a pthread pool as well. And the reason I could do that was another piece of code that Volker wrote called libthreadpool, which is an incredibly easy way to generate a worker thread pool that will, you can pass functions to it that this thread pool will implement. And then there's an AIO Linux module, which I'll go into afterwards. So as I say, shamelessly stolen from Volker's AIO fork code. And so this is an example of how CPUs aren't getting any faster, but they are getting more cores. How Samba, a big state machine though it is, that is not inherently threaded, Samba can actually use threads in areas that make sense. And this, I think, is the future for us in terms of code design. To go through and make Samba completely thread safe would probably take another 10 years, Samba 5, and, you know, we would be well and truly obsolete by the time we'd done it. And it would also be very hard. We would have tons and tons of bugs that we would have to get rid of. However, because of the VFS interface and the libthreadpool library, we can actually hide the use of threads behind non-threaded interfaces. And it works really, really well. So there's a maximum each thread. There's a maximum of 128 threads in the thread pool. And I thought about restricting that, and then Volker pointed out, no. Especially with SMB2, the goal is just keep as many spindles busy as you possibly can. And the great thing about libthreadpool is that if a thread turns out it has nothing to do for 1 second, it terminates itself. So it's capable of coping with very large bursts of I.O. And then going back down to a state where there are no outstanding threads attached to the process. So it's really nice. And again, all of this was done behind an interface that meant no code changes to SMBD whatsoever. Just behind the module interface. Thank you. So as I had, I was on a roll at that point, so I thought, well, let me see what else I can do. So I shamelessly stole my own code, which was stolen from Volker's code. And I instead of a thread pool, I implemented the Linux AIO interface. And that code is in master. The AIO pthread is so useful, it's backported to 3.6. It will be in the next feature release of 3.6. The AIO Linux, not so yet. I'm not convinced of its utility. Still testing with it. Theoretically, it would, at least on Linux, it would be the most resource-efficient way of doing asynchronous I.O. Because everything's done asynchronously at the system call level. No threads needed, no process pool. I'd still need to do more testing and more experimentation to know if it really does work. Yes. So I'm actually coming to the end of the talk, so I'm kind of right for about 5 minutes of questions. So that actually says, let 1,000 flowers bloom, T event in the asynchronous VFS. And that was a quote from Chairman Mao, so I couldn't miss reusing my Chairman Linus picture. So where we want to get to, so right now we've essentially solved the asynchronous I.O. problem. We can be asynchronous for reads and writes as much as we want. However, there are many other calls that we would like to be asynchronous. We would like opens to be asynchronous. We would especially like unlinks to be asynchronous because they can end up zeroing out a lot of data on a disk when you're removing a large file. Especially when you're working with clustered file systems, very occasionally, random file system calls that you would expect to be completed very quickly take a hell of a long time to complete. So where we'd like to get to, and this will almost certainly be solely SMB2, is you get the SMB2 request coming in, goes through the request parser, gets spun off into the asynchronous VFS backend, and then we continue processing. And then eventually we'll get notification that that is done. We'll pass the reply and ship it back out. So this is where T-Event comes in. We have this wonderful boilerplate system in T-Event of doing send and receive pairs. So right now, all the interfaces in the VFS are synchronous, except for the explicitly EIO calls. What we'd like to do is to change that VFS inside SAMR 4 and going forward into a completely asynchronous VFS. So we have send and receive call pairs. Now, this is going to make the VFS more complicated. It's not going to be a simple POSIX backend anymore, which is a shame. But if we port a lot of our existing modules over, and we produce a lot of example code, and this is why I'm so sorry I missed Richard's VFS talk, because I really wanted to know what he had to say. Essentially, we'll have to refactor the logic for the core file server. And we have to do this anyway to add more SMB2 and SMB3 stuff more cleanly. I think down there at the bottom, which you can't see, I believe David Disseldorp's... am I correct in saying your copy chunk is being refactored to be a send-receive pair asynchronous call, correct?
Yes, to the
yes, that's right. So this, so if you want to see how that's going to be done, take a look at David's patch to see how the send-receive pairs will be done inside the more modern VFS. So what are the numbers? Well, I was in Ara's talk this morning, and he gave you lots of numbers, so I don't feel too bad. So this is a slide, like I say, where I really ought to have a graph showing how when you turn on AIO, Samba goes 5 times faster and all this kind of stuff. But that's actually really hard to create, because it completely depends on the system that you're running it on. I actually did try, don't get me wrong, I would have loved to have had that slide, and I tried to get it. I went down to a small OEM and said, you know, who's local, and basically said, hey, let's turn on this AIO pthread and let me show numbers to the conference that show it, you know, doubling performance or whatever. And unfortunately, we ran it on one of their very small systems with an Atom processor, and it turned out that turning on asynchronous writes gave him another, properly asynchronous writes with the pthread module, gave him another 10% performance, which they were very happy about. Unfortunately, when the reads were done as well, it lost them 10% performance, which they were less happy about. But the beauty of the VFS is that you can actually choose which calls to use. So the pthread AIO VFS module is set up so that you can say, well, I want to have asynchronous IO on writes but not reads. So it turns out for their system, the zero copy send file, which obviously you can't do when you're doing asynchronous IO, that's actually much more important than the asynchronicity you get out of the VFS module. So that's it. Does anyone have any questions or comments?
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments? Yes.
Hi. So one question to IO thread. How do you cope with the problems that thread cannot switch the UID, and therefore how do you implement, for example, an async open?
So the question is, how do you implement async open because the threads can't switch UID?
Exactly.
That's going to be difficult. We may have to just lock the UID in place while we're doing that. Or the other possibility is we could spin off a process to do that, is the other possibility, and pass up the file descriptor. So that's going to be the hardest one to do, probably. Volker, do you want to make a comment on that?
The normal p-read, p-write calls don't have a problem because
they
are file descriptor based. And for the unlink and open and makeD and all these path-based calls, what we need is a helper process per user session, per user context. And whether that is then in itself threaded again so that it can handle multiple unlinks simultaneously for a single user context, that's open for discussion, but we need a process.
Any more questions, comments? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.